This is Gerald May, March 26, 1982. Care of mind, care of spirit.
It's really nice to be here with you. I've been enjoying your city that I'm sure everybody keeps saying is so beautiful. It really is. Well, Fran was talking about Shalem, the organization with which I work. That name referring to wholeness. And in reality, I guess the topic of my presentation this evening, Care of Mind, Care of Spirit, relates to wholeness as well. So really that's what I'm talking about. The main point that I would like to convey this evening is that while wholeness is a very beautiful and attractive and very good notion in our culture in these times, it is also not without its dangers. And I would like to raise just a bit of healthy caution about the whole notion of wholeness. And then perhaps proceed to affirm it. The caution has to do with wholeness, especially applying to mind and spirit, or psychology and spirituality. There is a kind of trickiness about much of the thinking that's going on these days in this arena. When we start to think about integrating spirituality and psychology, or integrating mind and spirit, the trickiness has to do with two things, basically. First, is that there really isn't anything to integrate, because we are whole. And while we might make some progress in attempting to integrate the way we think about mind and spirit, if we begin to assume that we're actually trying to integrate mind and spirit, then I think we're trying to bring something together that was never taken apart. So that's one of the trickinesses that I think needs to be raised as a caution. The other dimension that needs to be of concern to us, I think, has to do with an attitude which is very prevalent in our society these days, and it is an attitude which is fostered a great deal by psychology, and that is that if there is an integration to be accomplished, or a wholeness to be achieved, we have to achieve it ourselves. In other words, that becomes translated on many occasions as it is our job to engineer our own salvation. So in a way, that's kind of like assuming that there is a real fragmentation of mind from spirit, and we have to do the integrating. In fact, of course, all major spiritual traditions, and most especially the Christian tradition, constantly affirms that our wholeness has already been given to us, and that it is not something for us to achieve. It is perhaps something to recognize, something to discover in a sense of taking the cover off. Most basically, I think it is a gift that we simply need to learn to accept. Now, the danger of those two mistaken assumptions that are quite prevalent, that the danger that occurs in attempting to integrate psychology and spirituality, or mind and spirit, in the name of wholeness or of spiritual growth, is that what is spiritual will become, in our minds, reduced to a psychological technique. In other words, we may use our prayer experience to amplify and magnify our sense of self-importance, our sense of autonomous mastery in the world. This happens again and again, and it is a very subtle thing. Let me give you some examples. They may not be fair examples, but I think they may communicate what I'm talking about. I'd like you to make a contrast here between an old poem that deals with what I think is a very accurate and legitimate attempt to describe spirit, contrasted with a quote from the cover of a recent book that is an attempt to integrate psychology and spirituality. That's why it's not really fair, because one is a great poem and the other is a book cover quote. But I think it will communicate what I'm attempting to say here. Before I proceed, by the way, some of the things that I say, especially early on in my talk, are going to sound, I think, very harsh against psychology and psychiatry and the behavioral sciences. I hope you will keep in mind as I say these things that I am a psychiatrist and I make my living that way. I do offer psychotherapy, and I place a great deal of credibility on the disciplines of the behavioral sciences. Having said that, now I can proceed to sound like I'm disparaging them. Okay, let me ask you to contrast these quotes. The first is a very famous few lines from Wordsworth's Lines, which I think is an excellent, very human kind of attempt to reflect an experience of spirit. You're probably familiar with them. "For I have learned to look on nature, not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still sad music of humanity, nor harsh nor grating, though of ample power to chasten and subdue. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime, of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things." Now that, I think, at least in my opinion, is a pretty heartfelt expression of an experience of spirit. Now, I'd like you to contrast that sense with this quote from the book cover. This is a decent book, by the way, and it is a legitimate attempt to integrate modern psychological approaches with prayer. And it places, for example, many, many psychological techniques like journal keeping and guided imagery and even a bit of primal screaming in the context of prayer. And it's a legitimate attempt to do that. It's a legitimate attempt to make that kind of integration. This is what the book jacket says. The author's psycho-spiritual tactics help you to draw on your own inner resources, as well as the divine, to re-energize your life and attain wholeness. The prayer strategies are easy and enjoyable and take limited time and can easily be built into one's daily schedule. You see how I had to apologize in advance for sounding disparaging, and it really is not a fair kind of comparison, but it does, I think, communicate the difference. From another vantage point, I think all we need to do is to make another comparison of many of the book titles and workshop titles, for example, that have been very, very popular in the United States recently, that are attempts to move towards wholeness. This is an example of the other kind of distortion that I was talking about, the idea that we need to engineer our own salvation. Book titles and workshop titles like Pulling Your Own Strings and Looking Out for Number One and Winning Through Intimidation and How to Say No Without Feeling Guilty and Success, You Can Make It Happen. Now, again, I caution, some of these are very good books, and I have suggested to some people with whom I'm working that they read some of these books. Okay. But there is a kind of quality of feeling about those titles. I'd like to contrast that with the famous words that most of you have heard, of Dag Hammarskjöld, written in 1961. I don't know who or what put the question. I don't know when it was put. I don't even remember answering. But at some moment, I did answer yes to someone or something. And from that hour, I was certain that existence is meaningful and that therefore my life in self-surrender had a goal. So, the point is, we need to take some care when we're moving in the direction of wholeness, if we think that means integrating mind and spirit, psychology and spirituality, psychological and spiritual techniques or understandings. That kind of reduction of spiritual reality into a kind of psychological thing happens oftentimes, I think, in our own spiritual growth, our attitudes towards ourselves. It is a way, for example, of spiritually having our cake and eating it too. What I mean by that is that the message of spirituality, and I don't really care what legitimate tradition this message comes from, in other words, what specific language it's phrased in, but the essential message has to do with saying yes and ultimately somehow surrendering. And that, of course, runs deeply counter to the main thrust of our culture and the main thrust of what psychology, psychotherapy is all about, which is autonomous mastery of destiny, for one's own destiny. And I'll say more about that later and try to get it, make some clear distinctions about that. But the point is that there is something about the spiritual call which is always deeply threatening to us at some level. It has something to do with dying to be reborn, something to do with losing yourself in order to find yourself. There is a challenge that goes exquisitely deep in the spiritual call. And we are, in one way or another, defended against that. There are parts of us that resist that kind of relinquishment that is called for, even though there are incredibly strong longings and achings and passions in our hearts for the reality of spiritual truth. Now, if, you see, we can substitute something psychological for the real spiritual challenge, then we can pretend at least a while to have our cake and eat it too, because we can say, I am growing in wholeness, I am growing in fullness, I am understanding myself, and that is my spiritual journey. But I don't have to give up that final me to find the real me. So there is that constant tendency within ourselves, which I've come to call a kind of spiritual narcissism, where we take our spiritual practice and our spiritual insight and we use it to build up our egos and our self-importance and our self-concern, rather than allow it to move us towards humility and compassion and recognizing our basic oneness with each other. Psychological insights and understandings can, in fact, be used as a defense against spiritual insight and understanding. So it happens to us individually like that. The other factor, of course, is that the psychological insights, techniques, and understandings are so much more graspable than the real spiritual senses and feelings, which are much, much more mystical, esoteric. They don't fit into words anywhere nearly as well. It's the spiritual journey is filled with moments of unknowing, of feeling a kind of emptiness, an almost holy spaciousness. And that is very, very difficult to say, well, this is the part of my mentality that this fits into and this leads to this and so forth, which psychology does offers that kind of objectification. So it becomes much more attractive than, for many reasons, to move into a psychological way of thinking about one's spiritual growth. It also happens in spiritual guidance, when one person is helping another person or people along their own spiritual journey or path. There are these days many, many occasions where what is called spiritual guidance or spiritual direction becomes, in fact, some kind of psychology, psychotherapy, counseling, in which the spiritual challenge is really missed, almost intentionally, as a manner of protecting oneself. Jacob Needleman has gone so far as to say that he thinks the disciplines of psychology or psychotherapy and spirituality or spiritual guidance should not be integrated at all, but should be separated for this very reason. The way he describes it, I think, is eloquent. He says that it is the job of the therapist, the psychotherapist, to help people solve their problems. It's the job of the therapist to help a person solve his or her problem. It is the job of the spiritual guide to help a person deepen his or her question. And it is well nigh impossible, he feels, for the therapist to help a person solve the problem without closing the question. Now, I think that is eloquent, and I agree. I agree that it is very difficult. I would not, however, go so far as to agree that the two things ought to be separated more. Well, the point is they're going to be pulled together, whether they should or shouldn't. They are being pulled together, the way we think about mind and spirit. So that's a given fact. And we could proclaim forever that they shouldn't if we felt that way, but it's happening in our society. So I think the situation is that as it happens, we need to have a kind of vigilance about it. We don't want to go rushing blindly into pulling together some hodgepodge of things just in the name of wholeness. Let's go back a little bit and look at how we got to be this way. In the early Hebrew understanding of person, as an example, as most of you probably know, there was no sense of compartmentalization. There was no sense of different parts of a person, body, mind, spirit, soul. There was, in fact, a belief in wholeness, which did not even have to be stated, because that's the way people were. We just were whole. There was no specialness about that. The imagery is that God created Adam out of clay. That's what the name Adam refers to. And breathed into Adam the breath of life, spirit. And thus created a soul. So that soul was not something that is a part of the person, was not something that comes and goes, but rather soul reflected the essence of being a person. It says, as Aelred Squire says, people do not have souls, they are souls. There were words for body and spirit and soul and different aspects of the human being, but these were seen only as aspects, facets, nothing compartmentalized. Now, we like to blame the Greeks for bringing upon us this, excuse me, the sense of compartmentalization. And in fact, Greek thought really did make some distinctions between different, some clearer distinctions between different aspects of people. That was not all bad. It allowed, for example, to really distinguish between spirit and body, spirit and flesh, allowed Western science to develop in a very constructive way. For example, it permitted Western science to develop the notion that there could be physical causes for physical diseases, rather than everybody, everything being a result of moral laxity or demonic possession, that there really could be physical problems for physical causes for physical disorders. And much more recently, within less than the past 100 years, that kind of separation has allowed the same sort of understanding psychologically, that there could be psychological causes for psychological disorders, that wasn't necessarily always a moral problem or a demonic problem. It really has been that recent. It was really not until the time of Freud that Western society really began to entertain the idea of psychological causes for psychological problems. Shortly prior to Freud's time, one of the major texts was Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, which stated that the affectations of the heart, which means mood and inclinations, that the affectations of the heart must spring from a chaste mind, that's A-S-T-E, not the other kind of chaste, and Christian piety. In other words, if you were feeling out of sorts, there was something wrong with your morality, basically. And you had to get right with God, and then you would feel better. Now, of course, Freud changed all that, and Freud's followers. Now, if you're feeling out of sorts, there's something wrong with your psyche, and you have to get right with that. There still is the idea that underneath all of that, that there's something wrong if you feel out of sorts, you know. And there's some real questions about that spiritually, of course, that maybe something about life which is inherently painful from time to time, and that every piece of pain that is felt is not necessarily a sign that something needs fixing. Well, my point in all of that was that the compartmentalization, the thinking about us as pieces, did permit some real progress. The price, however, has been high. The price has to do, of course, with beginning to think about ourselves and feel about ourselves as if we are somehow a collection of fragments. Perhaps the deeper price has to do with the whole idea of thinking about ourselves. Because a lot of times we think about ourselves or have thoughts about ourselves, and those thoughts become the substitute for ourselves. So it becomes increasingly hard, as we become more and more sophisticated, it becomes increasingly more difficult for us to just fully, freely live out of our essential being. And we are much more likely to be thinking about living fully. About is a very important word there. About means about, around the edges of it. It's not coming from the center. It's not fully coming from one's heart. The worst kind of price, I think, that has come out of this sense of fragmentation has been our desperate sense for, as I said, our desperate longing for wholeness, and our rather pitiful attempts to try to make that wholeness happen out here in the world of concepts. Because so often, as I have said, we do that, in doing that, we reduce our spiritual reality, even to the point of labeling our spiritual longing as a psychological problem. That is perhaps the most poignant situation of all for me. And thank the Lord it's happening less and less these days, but there has been a long period of time in our culture recently, a couple generations at least, where it was very, very common for someone longing for God, aching in their heart for a deep sense of a capacity to say yes, as Hammarskjöld was saying yes, and screwing up the courage to express that to someone, and then having that labeled as a dependency or as a lack of emotional maturity, or even worse, winding up in therapy about it and having it corrected. And that has happened. That has happened, and it is still happening. As I say, thank heavens, less than before. We are, I think, at least beginning to realize now that our most basic dis-ease about our life in our hearts may not be a disease at all, but may in fact be a call towards where our real hope lies for ourselves as individuals and perhaps as a race on the face of this planet. But it is out of this sense of compartmentalization that we today experience a great thrust towards wholeness, and wholeness becomes then a very pop and popular issue. It's interesting what has happened between psychology and religion along the lines of wholeness or integration. In the early part of this century, well, let's say in the middle part of the century, religion became acutely interested in psychology, especially Protestant religion. It had something to do with trying to be relevant, and it also had something to do with feeling a little bit of inadequacy about the spirit. Things had gotten a little too intellectual, maybe, in the theological realms, and perhaps a little dry spiritually. And the new burgeoning field of psychology seemed to be a chance of offering real help to people, something real, something really substantial, something that could be felt and experienced. So religion, religionists, religious people became very, very interested in psychology. Many of them became therapists. More recently, the reverse has been true, that increasingly psychotherapists are interested in religion, having found, of course, that psychology and psychotherapy and psychiatry don't have the ultimate answers. And so there's a kind of crazy crisscross of psychologically minded clergy and religious people crossing paths with spiritually minded psychotherapists and trying to meet each other somehow, but each sort of blindly fixed on their opposite goal, grass being greener and all of that. All of this attempt to get together between psychology and religion has led to some pretty great craziness. For example, we have now religious cults, of course, which use all the modern psychological techniques, not admitting it, but who use techniques of human relations training, who use encounter techniques, who use even brainwashing techniques. And on the other hand, we've got psychological growth organizations which are propounding to all intents and purposes a moral philosophy, evangelizing, proselytizing, collecting converts, and building communities around charismatic leaders without admitting that it's religious. So there is a fair amount of craziness going on individually and collectively. As I have said, I think the basic problem there is our mistaken assumption. First of all, that there's really something to integrate, and secondly, that we need somehow to achieve our own wholeness, our own salvation. Psychology, which is a child of our society and always has been, says that we must build and accomplish our own wholeness and make it as an achievement. Spirituality says simply accept the gift that's been given. Psychology, for example, tends to say that, and our society as a whole also tends to say, that we must somehow alter our consciousness to experience something mystical. That mystical spiritual experiences are now known in transpersonal psychology as ASCs, altered states of consciousness. Spirituality says perhaps the problem is that you're already altering your consciousness too much, and what you need to do is refrain from that. To refrain from the alterations that you heap upon yourself and simply notice what's there, what is truly naturally given. Psychology says, as our society does, the way to fulfillment in life is through mastery, through individual mastery. Spirituality kind of whispers, no, it's something more like mystery. And most threatening of all, as I've indicated before, psychology and our society say the only way to real fulfillment is to declare and establish your own autonomy and self-determination. And the spiritual traditions say surrender. Psychology in our society say, never give in. And the spiritual traditions say, give up. Up. Psychology in our society say, self-determination is the way to become an adult, to become mature, is to establish yourself autonomously, determining your destiny. And spirituality says you must become as a little child. Now that I've made all of those polarizing distinctions, it really does seem like there's something to integrate. And in terms of the way we think about things, I think there is. I would prefer and would pose, however, that maybe a better term is reconciliation rather than integration. I think the concepts, the way we begin to think about ourselves, since we have to think about ourselves, can be reconciled But I think we simply need to remember in the process of that reconciliation that any true integration has already happened. And if our concepts are really going to become integrated, then they have to simply be created out of the fullness and the wholeness which is already there. We're not going to make ourselves whole by putting ideas together. The ideas have to reflect the wholeness which is naturally given. Now, the first step, I think, towards a reconciliation along these lines has to do with making an affirmation about psychotherapy, psychology, and behavioral sciences. I hope I've gotten beyond my disparaging point in the talk at this point. There is much about psychology and the behavioral sciences that does need to be affirmed, and strongly so. There is even much that needs to be affirmed about that thrust of psychology towards autonomy and independence, because it is through the process of psychological autonomy and independence and securing of identity, if you will, that we are granted a measure of freedom, so that we are not so much automatic functions of our environment and our relationships, but have a freedom of will and a freedom of choice about our lives. Remember, though, that psychology and the behavioral sciences do not and cannot say what that freedom should be used for. It can only help to nurture and facilitate that freedom. The freedom, of course, the real value of it, has to do with the possibility of being free to choose to surrender, so that one is never forced into a surrender, because a legitimate spiritual surrender can never be forced. It has to be free. And the behavioral sciences can help us towards that freedom. We do, however, need to know when to stop in that course of growth that leads us to autonomy and independence and self-assertiveness and so forth. It often feels so good not to be the victim anymore, and to be able to say no without feeling guilty, and to be able to pull one's own strings a little bit rather than have somebody else pulling them. It often feels so good that we don't know when to stop. And it is out of that that some of us, beginning as passive, mealy-mouthed doormats, grow up and become obnoxious. Or that some of us, having been afraid to express any kind of feeling, having to repress every single emotion that came along, learn how to get in touch with our feelings, and then feel somehow obliged to express everything that comes along. And that, of course, at best can be fatiguing to everybody concerned. There is a point at which the freedom is full enough, and we do not have to blindly remain attached to the continuing snowballing process of securing more and more self-assertiveness and territory and expression. But is that kind of affirmation that I think is the first step in a reconciliation of psychology and spirituality, of mind and spirit. The second step, I think, has to do with some kind of growing appreciation of what spiritual surrender really means, what it's really about. And the first aspect of that is that it implies in no way a passivity or a quietism. Nor does it deny our knowledge or our science or any of the abilities which we have grown into through our thinking. But it is, in fact, a surrender which allows us fully, completely, to be given into life with all of our abilities, all of our knowledge, and all of our capacity to act. Spiritual surrender to me has something to do with a courageous humility, or humble courage, if you will. A humility which does not cause one to say, oh no, I can't do that. But a humility tempered with courage, which allows one to say, of course I can't do that alone. And then proceed to participate in whatever it is that's needed. Finally, I think spiritual surrender has to do with learning how to accept gifts. Because that is not something we are taught. We are taught how to build things for ourselves. We are taught at sometimes how to take things from other people. We are taught certainly how to market well so that we can exchange and work out situations where we will meet somebody else's needs and they will meet ours. But we are not taught how to accept gifts. Take, for example, the gift of your breathing. This is a bit of a corny example, but I think it's accurate. Your breathing is a gift. You've been sitting there all during this long-winded talk breathing. And it's a gift. You haven't been got to take each breath. But let me just ask you for 2 seconds now to notice that gift of your breathing and see if you can accept it. Can you notice your breathing without getting your grubby hands all over it and messing with it? Something as simple as that. Don't know how to accept. What's given. Or we can think about our hands, which are, I think, great symbols of how we are in life. At the beginning of Shalem, when Shalem, my organization in the District of Columbia, started, we had a consultant, so to speak, who was a Tibetan Lama, two-legged kind of Lama, who used to like to say that there were 3 kinds of people in the world. Psychologists, religious people, and scientists. And he said that a religious person coming upon something in life goes, psychologist coming upon something in life goes, and scientist coming upon something in life goes. But if you think about your hands in terms of surrender, spiritual surrender, the kind of surrender which is a willingness towards the divine, a willingness towards God's will, a surrender that says, not my will but thine be done. The most common mistake we make, and perhaps the most common distortion that we make about that, is to think that our hands in spiritual surrender are held away somehow so that we remain passive and quietistic and inactive. But let me just suggest to you that this kind of thing, this kind of working at life and grasping and pushing and accomplishing, that is willfulness if it is coming from our own self-determination to master everything. But if we sit on our hands and restrain them in the name of surrender or anything else, that is just as willful. That is every bit as willful. It doesn't matter whether you're being willful in terms of activity and accomplishing something or whether you're being willful in terms of passivity and restraining yourself from responding to the world. So that the true spiritual surrender in terms of the hands is a readiness of the hands to do what is needed, which may be a kind of quiet openness at some times. It may be an active involvement at other times. But there is a flow of it, there is a dance of it that is not tensely driven, nor is it forcibly frozen. Now, those are subtle qualities, and I don't have good words for them, but I think it may communicate the quality of what I think spiritual surrender really can be. So that kind of affirmation of what psychology and the mind and our knowledge and so forth can offer us, and some beginning appreciation about what spiritual surrender really means, I think are important steps towards a reconciliation of mind and spirit. What we're really talking about is thoughts about mind and spirit, of course. Now, I'm getting close to the end. I think we could take a brief look at what this whole business might begin to mean in terms of day-to-day life, a little more practical dimension. As individuals, this sense of reconciliation, the process of reconciliation, psychological ways of thinking and spiritual ways of thought might help us to begin to recognize how, in fact, we really are made in the image and likeness of God. See, that does not make sense if we are autonomous masters trying to play God. We're trying to play God, it does not make any real sense how we're made in God's image and likeness. It also might help us begin to recognize our essential and immutable value to God and to ourselves and to each other. Some kind of beginning incarnational sense of the godness of who we really are, out of which we are created. I think that the spiritual traditions, the legitimate spiritual traditions of the world, have also indicated that when there is a reconciliation of this fragmented way we have about thinking about ourselves and a willingness to surrender into some kind of full, active, dynamic, lively life, there is also a realization of the love out of which we are created. Some sense, perhaps, almost of being in love, like we are in the air that we breathe. That love no longer becomes just something we conjure up to give to somebody else or receive, although that's part of it. But there is a quality of love that we are all in together, that is around us and in us and through us, and very live and very energetic. Practical considerations about that individually, I think, have to do with recognizing that while we can and must participate in our own spiritual growth, there is no way that we can make it happen, and there is no way that it can be our achievement. That we are called to respond to and nurture our own spiritual growth. But everything that happens, every step of the way, is a gift. And in a way that sounds paradoxical, but in my opinion, it is the message of the spiritual traditions of the world that that's the way things are. They are, in fact, paradoxical. There is something also about developing an attitude of gentleness towards oneself in all of this. Some kind of realization, I guess, that if our wholeness has in fact been given to us, and if perhaps we are already altering our consciousness too much, that maybe the way towards some deeper appreciation of who we really are is not to pound ourselves and whip ourselves into further accomplishment and complexity, but some kind of gentleness which might begin to allow the kind of tender bud of who we are to emerge, come out from under all of the hassle. That also implies a very courageous openness of heart, a willingness to accept, as best we can, at least, the possibility that we are not who we think we are. That we are not, in fact, our images of ourselves. That maybe the way in which we really are made in the image and likeness of God is that our essential nature is endlessly mysterious, as is God's. That there is much about us that is real and substantial and sayable, but that at core there are dimensions of ourselves which will remain eternally mysterious, as with God. And our images of ourselves are not ourselves any more than our images of God are God. They are at best symbols, at best expedient ways of communicating, helpful tools. They are not the thing. And most basically, probably, the sense that grows out of that kind of reconciliation is that neither God nor we are things, in any sense of that word. Much too rich, much too lively to be called a thing. So that as children, we really grow rather than be built. And when we are disordered in one way or another, physically or emotionally, we really heal rather than are fixed. there is an ongoing, eternally mysterious process in life in which we can, at our fullest, be very, very lively participants in. The other practical dimension, and then I'll close, is how this applies to spiritual guidance and counseling and psychotherapy. There is, I think, in this realization, in the context of spiritual guidance, and even in the context of psychotherapy, when this realization exists and is a lively reality, a sensed reality, that we are really not one person helping another person accomplish something. We are not in a position of building or correcting something in another being. We are not in the process of even nurturing another being towards God. But in fact, at the deepest level of our existence, we are that other being, and they are we. And that in our independence, in our full selfhood, we are joined irrevocably in God. And God is working in our soul. And that's where it is all happening. And that is how it is happening. So that occur in the context of moving towards wholeness and integration. I think it is possible to recognize the great psychological spiritual paradox, and that is that our fullest autonomy, our fullest lively independence, occurs with a full recognition and realization of our utter dependence upon God and upon each other. That's idealistic. But it is a goal, I think, that we might keep before us. Okay, let's have some coffee, and then we'll come back for discussion. Get ourselves gathered. Perhaps there are some questions, comments, reflections, whatever that I might respond to. Yeah. Did you all hear that? I was supposed to repeat. Is there anybody that did not hear that? Would I speak to the concept of wholeness relating to the Eastern tradition and especially to life after death? Eastern, you meaning Oriental, not Eastern Orthodox. All right. In general, Oriental religion has never made anywhere near as much of a separation between mind and spirit and body as we have. So that, for example, Buddhist psychology is psychology is an essential part of Buddhism, and Buddhist psychology is nothing special. We would be hard put at this day and age to try to find what is a Christian psychology. So that my sense is that in fact, in this arena of psychology, spirituality, the Eastern religions are far ahead of Western religions because they haven't had to deal with that kind of fragmentation. And interestingly enough, there really isn't, to my knowledge, any clear drive towards wholeness in the Eastern religions, because the same reason, that there hardly needs to be. There is a sense of one being whole to begin with. What substitutes for that, of course, or what is kind of in the place of that, is enlightenment or liberation or salvation. There tends to be, at least especially in Western interpretations of Eastern religion, there tends to be a sense that there is a little bit more you can do about it yourself. In other words, there's a great deal of emphasis in Buddhism, for example, and Hinduism, upon practice, spiritual practice, intentional spiritual practice, which in translation into English communicates that there's kind of a cause and effect, that if you practice long enough in the right way, you'll get enlightened. And that, of course, ends the cycle of birth and death and creates a final liberation. My guess is, and I'm not that much of an authority, but my guess is that sense of accomplishing it oneself is really a Western interpretation, that it is not that strong in the traditions themselves, that in fact there is a very strong sense of reliance upon other people, of reliance upon, in Buddhism, what's called the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, or a whole range of deities in Hinduism, and karma, that are all major influences upon the course of one's spiritual growth, or upon the course of towards enlightenment. So that there also, while there's a great deal of emphasis on practice, it is not at all clear that it is a cause-effect relationship, that practice causes enlightenment. It is very distinct in Christianity, of course, that we do not accomplish our own enlightenment or our salvation, that has been given to us. So it's much more explicit. That aspect of it is much more explicit in Christianity. The other dimension that could relate to wholeness, I guess, I think has to do with the, in both Eastern and Western traditions, a sense that one's spiritual endeavors, whether they be seen as practice or prayer, worship, liturgy, ascetical practices, fasting, things like that, that whatever one's spiritual practice is, it is not specifically directed towards the end of one's own spiritual growth. In other words, we do not pray specifically towards the end of accomplishing something for ourselves. While that may be a motivation psychologically, the effect is not necessarily that. The effect is, in fact, an addition to compassion in the world. the effect of all spiritual practice, spiritual discipline, prayer, worship, is somehow to magnify the existence of love among all people. And that is a theme which exists in all of this, the spiritual traditions, and is very clear in Christianity as well. Life after death is, I don't know what more I can say about that in terms of wholeness, except simply that there is a sense of liberation from what in the East is seen as a problematic condition. In other words, our dualistic world, our dualistic life, the life in which we see ourselves as separate and autonomous, is in the East, Eastern thought, a problem. It is a delusion, it is an illusion, and it creates problems. It is something to be overcome. One of the major differences between East and West, I think, is that in Western monotheistic traditions, our separateness, our brokenness, our autonomy is, in fact, a God-given condition. And it is not to be seen as a problem. Even when it is interpreted as a manifestation of original sin, is not to be seen as a problem. It is a condition which is given by God and has within it, within our brokenness, within our sense of separation and fragmentation, there is something of the potential for the kingdom of heaven more fully, or some kind of growth in the world, so that there is a sense in Western tradition that there is some very specific grace in our brokenness that does not exist, to my knowledge, in Eastern tradition. So they say much more about life after death, except that's a liberation in both systems, taking different forms. The question is to elaborate a little bit on how psychiatry or psychology and spirituality are drawing closer together. Well, one thing that comes to mind is the whole movement of transpersonal psychology, which is perhaps the most recent major movement of the behavioral sciences. Abraham Maslow talked about three forces in psychology in the 20th century, the sort of Freudian and behavioral and human potential movement forces. In a way, I think sensing that there was, in the evolution of psychology, when I say psychology, I'm talking about the whole arena of psychiatry and behavioral sciences, that there was a kind of movement away from, like, Freud's original focus on a specific interior of an individual to relationships among people, where you get into things like family systems and human potential and that sort of stuff, to a transpersonal kind of approach, like Jung, for example, which goes beyond even relationships to a kind of sense of commonality of the race of humanity, that there is an expansion of focus. Freud had an id psychology, and then neo-Freudian said, an ego psychology, and then there's interpersonal psychology, and then there's a collective psyche, a collective unconscious psychology, and then there's a real transpersonal, which goes even beyond the human-centered focus, or at least attempts to. Now, this movement of transpersonal psychology has been called the fourth force of psychology in Western society, and it in fact does deal primarily with what have to be called spiritual techniques, understandings, insights, and so forth. And there is very legitimate, there's a transpersonal psychology association, a couple of journals, a lot of books being published, and so forth. The problem with it, of course, is that it falls prey in large part to the kinds of problems that I was discussing earlier, where the spiritual insights and technologies become adjuncts to therapy. And that always becomes a bit of a octopus that gets kind of snaggled around, because psychology, by its very nature, being essentially human-centered, cannot ever be large enough to make spirituality its adjunct. By definition, it can't. On the other hand, spirituality, by definition, has to always be big enough to embrace psychology. And it's that kind of prioritizing relationship, the relativizing of the disciplines, that it becomes critically important. And so transpersonal psychology, a great deal of it, is still in the business of trying to appropriate spiritual stuff and use it to accomplish psychological ends. So one, you know, if it's got a phobia, you try to find some way of generating some sort of spiritual energy or some form of meditation that might deal with that phobic problem. Try to lower your blood pressure, get rid of a migraine headache with meditation and stuff like that. Some of which works, not a whole lot, really does work. Very well, but it's like prayer can become a tranquilizer then, you know, and if that's taken to an extreme. But there are increasing numbers of people within the transpersonal psychology field who are beginning to sense, I think, and to do some writing about not just appropriating the techniques of spirituality or spiritual disciplines, traditions, but in fact beginning to recognize that that kind of relationship that's so important, sort of like. Psychology fundamentally tells us, helps us to learn to live more efficiently. It says a lot about how to live, but it can never say anything about why we are alive or what we're living for, and that one really has to step beyond that. And there is some material coming out that kind of addresses that. It's threatening as all get out, because it does not, in fact, destroy the scientific method. It, in fact, really affirms it tremendously. But to find the words to use to describe what's going on there, it sounds like an attack upon the scientific method, an attack upon science, an attack upon the very good kinds of technologies that we do have. So it's rough. So that's one sort of hopeful kind of thing. there are increasing numbers of psychiatrists, clinical psychiatrists, who are just becoming religious fanatics. And I think that's a real sign of hope. It's sort of like, you know, you spend all this time acting like you know what to do to help someone. And every once in a while, I guess probably once every 38 minutes, another psychiatrist bites the dust with that and says, I don't know. I really don't know. And I have to relinquish something here, and I have to allow myself to be a little bit more of an instrument. And I have to acknowledge that. So that, again, several years ago, the president of the Canadian Psychiatric Association said, the only hope for mental health is Jesus Christ. And everybody went. Eric Fromm said, from Mexico, quietly, the only hope for mental health is Zen. When we go extreme. You know? But that's happening. And it comes out of the way, I suppose, the vast majority of sophisticated, well-trained people in our society find faith, and that is out of despair. Pushing your own knowledge and power and belief that you can understand everything to the limit until there's nothing more to learn, or you just burn out that whole idea that if I just learn the next, go to the next workshop or read the next book or acquire the next insight that it'll all come together for me and I'll be able to know how to live. That just cracks, and there's a moment of despair, and it's in that moment that that people really have to open up, to the spirit. So that kind of thing is happening all over the place, and I think that is much better. It's much safer when it happens that way to a real competent secular psychiatrist who bites the dust and says, I don't know what basically this is all about, and I have to somehow get religious, but then goes on practicing competent secular psychiatry coming from a religious heart. That is much, much more trustworthy than the psychiatrist or psychologist who says, I'm doing spiritual therapy because I've got everybody meditating and I know all the mantras and I know all the energy systems. Because the one is really spiritually humble with an open heart, even though the outward techniques may be very secular. The other, while the outward techniques may be very spiritual in appearance, they're used to a kind of self-serving psychological end, which I think can really be destructive. I went off your question a little bit there, but those are some evidences. There are a lot of others. Religions move towards psychology, very much, but it's done so primarily at the price of throwing the baby Jesus out with the bathwater. And now some of the religionists who went that direction are beginning to come back. Now, there is a movement in pastoral counseling, for example, now to really address the spirit. And that was the last bastion across the country, anyway. The pastoral counseling movement has been probably the most secular of all therapies. So it really is happening. Yeah, in the back. Okay, the question has something to do with courage in psychiatry and in spiritual direction, and maybe that there's a difference. The courage required in spiritual direction is inevitably and necessarily much greater than in any kind of psychiatric or psychological therapy or counseling. because you're dealing with a situation in which the very sense of self is threatened. And in spiritual guidance, in traditional spiritual direction, it is not a matter of the spiritual director looking at the spiritual directee and saying, this person's sense of self is threatened and we have to do that. That is a little bit more psychiatric. But in fact, in the conduct of spiritual guidance, legitimate, formal, traditional spiritual direction, in the conduct of it, the director, himself or herself, must relinquish that, or be at least willing to relinquish that self-sense in order to respond to what is needed for the person being guided. In most traditional psychiatry, psychology, psychotherapy relationships, and I hedge that because, you know, there are many overlaps nowadays, but in the traditional sense, the courage takes a very different form. It has something to do with maintaining one's own self-sense, sort of in the name of objectivity, or to be able to empathize and understand and really relate and listen with the third ear and sense what's going on with a person and how oneself is responding to that, without losing the kind of autonomy and identity which is required to take action. To think through the alternatives about what's going on and what to do. So it's really, you know, I can make a kind of, it's arbitrary, but it's almost like a polar opposite of courage there in terms of what happens to one's sense of self, image. You know. It is arbitrary, and there are overlaps. It also has to do with the difference between discernment and diagnosis. Discernment is perhaps the essential component of spiritual direction in classic Christian tradition. The discernment of spirits, the discernment of motive forces and inclinations that that a person experiences. It's what spiritual direction means. What kind of direction should a person follow on the spiritual journey? That's what the spiritual director helps find. The discernment, which means seeing through, the ability to separate, see through, is considered to be a gift. It's a charism. It's a gift of discernment, and it has very little to do with the specific knowledge of the spiritual guide or director. Diagnosis, on the other hand, means through knowledge, or thorough knowledge, as in the Greek translation. In I don't know what gospel it, or what book it is in the New Testament, but there's use of the word diagnosis as the diagnosis of the emperor, as the judgment, the knowledge emphasis, gnosis is knowledge. The whole scenario about diagnosis has a subtly different aspect from that seeing through as a gift. It is learning the signs and symptoms of this as compared to that, and being able to differentiate and be able to think through in a clear, logical fashion, which is far more dependent upon the knowledge of the practitioner. Now, there is an art of diagnosis, too. So again, there's, you know, it's, I'm making a kind of arbitrary distinction, but I think those kinds of distinctions are important to keep in mind.
Spirituality and psychology have sort of come together
You mean like the pop psycho-spiritual movements? Is that what you're talking about? Well, modern movements in a country that combine psychological and spiritual, or groups around the human, groups that are part of that. Well, the ones that are sort of 20th century inventions, the movements, the psycho-spiritual movements that are 20th century inventions, will often develop their own ethical standards. Est, for example, has a set of ethical standards. It becomes, in fact, almost moral and immoral. There are, I think, probably any group that begins to establish itself and continue as a community and collect converts and so forth, act like a religion, does develop a system of values. The problem with it is that if it is a 20th century invention, the values are coming from strange places. The values may be based on a psychological understanding, for example. Like the value, the kind of overall cultural value that all feelings should be expressed all the time. That is in a way an ethical kind of statement that comes through psychology. It's a counteraction to the old past century moral statement that said all feelings are bad and you should never express anything except for a slight bit of righteous indignation in church sometimes about what was called a healthy hatred of scoundrels. You could have a little bit of that, but everything else had to be essentially repressed or suppressed because just feelings are not trustworthy and they get you into trouble. Cardinal Newman wrote a little poetry. It's something like, "He who lets his feelings run in soft, luxurious flow faints when there's hard work to be done and shirks from every woe." Well, that was the kind of moral, ethical thing about feelings in those days. And now there's the reverse. It is an ethic in some settings that, you feel guilty if you don't express something. When I get angry and I don't express it, I feel guilty because I should. It's like a reverse. So the ethics I think there are ethics that develop, but they're kind of crazy sometimes. And they're not, the original moralities, I think, this is my own assumption here, but the original moralities that come out of major spiritual traditions, major religion, major world religions, came out of strong spiritual experience. They arose out of it. They arose out of a spiritual experience which was either visionary, revelatory, some kind of very powerful experience out of which the value system emerged, so that the spirituality, the core of the spirituality was the core of the value system. Much of what kind of happens popularly, it doesn't have that quality at all to it. It's sort of like, let's see, we're doing this and this and this, and we define wholeness and growth as this and this and this, therefore it's logical that we ought to behave in such and such a way. That's kind of invented. So I don't think that the new systems do without ethics. I just think that oftentimes they're kind of jerry-built. Just a couple more. How about him? What do you mean? Well, Jung is the best there is. I think. That is not saying that that Jung is anything terribly transcendent. Jung is extremely popular these days among transpersonal psychologists and the whole arena of integrating spirituality and psychology, because like nobody else, Jung did integrate a lot of the concepts. But he, in my opinion, fell prey to the same kind of problem that I was talking about earlier, which was essentially reducing the transcendence of God. So that God is an archetype to Jung. And the archetype comes from the psyche, and the psyche is person-centered. Person meaning people, racial-centered. It's better than Freud by a long shot, but it's still psychology, and it's still essentially humanistic. There is a book by Martin Buber called The Eclipse of God, in the back of which there's a letter kind of dialogue with Jung, in which Buber tackles Jung on specifically that point, Jung's inability to deal with the transcendence of God, and tackles him very well. So I don't mean to disparage him, because I really do think he's the best there is. You know, there's no question about it. The best psychologist dealing with spiritual issues, but he remains a psychologist. He was a very spiritual man, very spiritual man. But his writings and teachings, and most especially how they get translated in action, are just psychological. You mean talking about Jung? Well, I think Jung handled that aspect of it pretty well. Jung talked about individuation being essentially becoming what you're meant to be. And certainly was able to acknowledge that life is painful, not easy, and that and the fullness of life did not mean absence of discomfort. So in that sense, Jung did not at all, I don't think, fall prey to that rather popular notion that if you live your life correctly, you're going to be happy all the time. Does that speak to what you were saying? Enough? Yeah. One more, right? What was the first part of you? Yeah. Gentleness. Given that life is painful, say more about gentleness to oneself and spirit. That's a good ending question. A good deal of life's pain is because we aren't gentle with ourselves. A good deal of the pain that we experience on a day-to-day basis is because we aren't gentle. It is the result of our own harshness. And that harshness can take a million different forms. It can be a driving of oneself to say, if I do this or that, if I think this or that, if I feel this or that, I will be better. And then we start doing this kind of thing to ourselves, making an object of ourselves, fix, build, manipulate. And whenever we run into confusions in life, we assume that the way out is to learn something more. In other words, the way out is always to add to the collection of debris that we must constantly be dealing with. Gentleness towards oneself has the attitude of, first of all, giving space for a breath. When there is something sensed being wrong, when there is some difficulty or some dissatisfaction with oneself, that rather than immediately leaping to whip oneself into shape, there's the possibility of simply taking a breath and pausing, however briefly, to notice what's happening. You know, just this, the moment of this. And in that moment of awareness of who you are and what you're experiencing, there is a kind of healing that takes place without anything more being done. I'm not saying that we never do anything or never should do anything, but I think the gentleness possibility lies in that pause before we leap to whip ourselves in one direction or another. It also lies in the possibility of considering that if we are confused, perhaps perhaps the answer is not to add something more to ourselves, but to begin to allow what's there to percolate or settle. In other words, gentleness implies either a risk or a trust that there is something beyond our will that has a potential for healing and growth and help in us. It does not necessarily imply that that's God. I think we can be, you know, people don't have to relate to God to move towards gentleness. However, gentleness does eventually relate, you know, move towards God, I think. But it's a sense that there is something, some process underneath our willfulness that is somehow good, you know, that is somehow fundamentally good. And we move towards that either with a sense of risking, in a sense, I hope that's true. I'm going to pause for a minute and I hope that's true. Or trusting, I know that's true. And I know that I'm kind of kidding myself when I think I have to do it all. So gentleness, I think, is a practice in a way. It is what can create enough space for just the barest beginning sense of our own real potential and our own real nature. It's the barest beginning sense of some kind of beginning flexibility rather than a frozen rigid image of who we are, who we ought to be, how we ought to get there. Most fundamentally, I think, in relating to part of the question about life being painful, is that gentleness gets us beyond a certain degree of tension about our own pain. You know, it's sort of like the lessons of natural childbirth, for example, of how there are ways of being with pain, which does not take the pain away, does in no way deaden yourself to it, but allows you to kind of flow on the waves of it in such a way that you do not suffer so much. Suffering is the tension that we develop about pain. And there is a way, through gentleness, of a kind of relaxing into the ebb and flow of pain. And does not imply that we don't try to do anything to stop the pain. You know, I mean, if pain is a problem and if it's a symptom, it needs to be addressed and looked at. But there are elements of pain in life that are given that there's nothing we can do about. And gentleness implies not getting too tense about it. And then what happens, I think, is that in moving through the clouds of our own pain, we move towards what Thomas Merton called the desert of compassion, in which we really then become capable of really knowing the world's pain, knowing the pain of the race, knowing the pain of the planet. And that is the gift, I think, that comes when we are gentle enough to move through our preoccupation with our own pain. And that is what compassion is. Merton called it a desert and said that there was no desert, no wilderness so fierce as compassion, and yet no desert that was so filled with the potential of blooming blossoms and fruit and flowering trees as the desert of compassion. Because that's where we're all one. That's where we know we're all one. And that's where I think our hope really lies. And at this day and age, it's conceivable that's where our only hope lies. It just conceivably might not be any other way for us as a race. And on that uplifting note, good night. It's been a pleasure.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.